This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
As the pandemic flares up, so does the finger pointing. In Kenya, they're wondering what happened to their medical supplies.
There are numerous millionaires because of the COVID-19. This is not a laughing matter.
Also today, Bill Gates has been the target of a lot of COVID conspiracy theories. The harm from hoaxes, he says, goes well beyond him.
To the degree they cause people not to wear masks or seek out the vaccine, you know, or to think this is all some big conspiracy, that's unfortunate.
And hey, all you dog-loving Germans, your pooch is losing it. Take her for a walk. It could soon be the law. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We start this Friday checking in on Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny. For the past 2 days, he's been in a medically induced coma in a hospital in Siberia after falling seriously ill on a flight to Moscow. His team suspects he was poisoned while drinking a cup of tea. Today at the hospital in the Russian city of Omsk, high drama, members of Navalny's team have been there, as well as doctors with a German nonprofit trying to evaluate what's going on. A video posted on Twitter shows police preventing Navalny's wife, Yulia, from learning anything about her husband's condition. Police officers there saying to Navalny's wife, "You'll learn everything at the press briefing." Well, since that briefing, here's what we know. Navalny has been given permission to leave Russia for treatment in Germany. Nikita Kulichenkov is on the investigations team at the Anti-Corruption Foundation, founded by Alexei Navalny. Nikita is in Vilnius in Lithuania, where he's closely following the latest on his colleague. And he said he was very skeptical of any statements the Russian doctors made about Navalny to their German counterparts.
The Russian doctor said that the German doctors, something like they do not disagree with him staying in the hospital in Russia or something like that, which is like which enraged many people after they told that.
And what had been the reasoning, Nikita, that Russian officials gave for keeping Navalny in Omsk and not letting him go to Germany?
Well, the conspiracy here is because they try to keep him as long as possible so the poison will disappear from his tests or something like that, which makes sense because someone poisoned him. So I think they tried to just cover the poison.
What has been the Kremlin's response to this, and what about response from other world leaders?
Well, the Kremlin response, I'm trying to calm down speaking about the Kremlin's response, because again, like an hour ago, there was a press statement from some top level official of the European Union who called Putin and told they discussed Belarus and they discussed Navalny accordingly. And he like says that Putin told him that he's just sick and he gets proper medical treatment. So, well, maybe I'm not pronouncing that properly in English, but in Russian, like he caught a cold or something like that. This is what Putin said, according to the European guide.
Nikita, you well know this is just the latest drama involving an apparent attack on Alexei Navalny. What is it like to be one of his allies right now?
Well, we pray that he has enough health to cope with that. I remember 2 years or 2 years ago we discussed with him the poisoning of Vladimir Karamurza, who is another important figure in the Russian opposition. He once got the, I don't remember the symptoms, but he was really sick, and it's like some unknown, with a known poison. We discussed that and we thought, okay, maybe he ate something. And in a year later, the same happened to him. And then I remember that we discussed with Alexei that it's now it's definitely poisoning and someone trying to poison him.
With that advice from Vladimir Kara-Murza, did Navalny ever speak to you about death, about like what would happen if his life were under threat?
No, I don't remember discussing what's going to happen if he will die. But I remember his usual joke about the interviews and journalists, like when someone has approached him and some journalists approached him and he says, "Are you going to ask me why I'm still alive?" So this is the question which and he just tired of these questions and like treat them with humor.
Nikita Kulichenkov is on the investigations team at the Anti-Corruption Foundation, an organization founded by Alexei Navalny. Nikita, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for calling. You're welcome.
On the last night of the Democratic National Convention, Joe Biden took President Trump to task for his handling of the coronavirus.
The president keeps telling us the virus is going to disappear. He keeps waiting for a miracle. Well, I have news for him. No miracle is coming.
Roughly 175,000 people have died here in the U.S. The World's Sarah Birnbaum has this update on the rest of the globe.
In Europe, it looked like things were under control, but now not so much. Take Germany. Last month, Chancellor Angela Merkel indirectly criticized Trump's handling of the virus in a speech to the European Parliament.
Mit Lüge und Desinformation lässt sich die Pandemie nicht.
She said, "You can't fight a pandemic with lies and disinformation." She chose to fight the virus with mass testing and an early rapid response. But once Germany's lockdown eased, cases shot up. Now, at least 41 schools in Berlin have reported outbreaks, this just 2 weeks after schools reopened. Still, the German government continues to stress that keeping schools open remains a top priority. In Kenya, the government is trying to contain the fallout from a news investigation that aired over the weekend.
Has this pandemic produced COVID-19 millionaires?
Absolutely. There are numerous millionaires.
Back in March, the Chinese billionaire Jack Ma donated plane loads of masks, tests, and other supplies to Kenya to help fight the virus. Now, this report says those supplies, which were supposed to go to the Kenyan people, were actually smuggled into Tanzania and sold, with the money going to corrupt officials. The Minister of Health denies the accusations. Meanwhile, some important background to all of this is that dozens of doctors are on strike in Kenya, partly because the government hasn't given them adequate PPE. So we talked about Europe, Africa, and now Asia.
जबकि 983 मरीजों की मौत हुई है.
कुल मरीजों की संख्या बढ़कर 29,05,000.
As of this moment, India has over 29 lakh COVID cases.
India has registered a record number of new COVID-19 cases with the highest single-day spike.
India is about to hit a sad milestone. Almost 3 million confirmed cases of coronavirus. COVID-19 seems to be spreading faster in India than in any other country in the world. And if the infection rate keeps rising, India will overtake Brazil as the world's second most affected country. So, is there any good news? Yeah. Some scientists in Singapore say a coronavirus mutation, which is now in Europe, North America, and Asia, is less deadly than the original virus. But Dr. Paul Tembaya, a virus expert at Singapore's National University Hospital, told Channel News Asia that we can't let our guard down.
So, you know, just because the virus may be slightly less virulent doesn't mean we should be complacent or we should, you know, stop doing the things that we are doing in terms of contact tracing, isolation, identification of cases, etc.
Good advice. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Another big COVID-19 outbreak in South Korea, big by Korean standards anyway. The country's been singled out for its success in fighting the pandemic, but in the past week, nearly 2,000 new cases. It's the country's second largest group infection. Korean officials are holding a controversial pastor and his church followers responsible. From Seoul, Jason Strother has our story.
Banners hanging outside the Sarangjaeol Church say that because of the rapid spread of COVID-19 in the area, no one can enter or gather nearby. Authorities say they've tested over 3,000 church members and around 20% are infected. Kim Gwan-lip, a health official, says this crisis has forced South Korea to raise its pandemic alert level. Here he is speaking through an interpreter at a daily briefing this week.
The metropolitan area will be subject to toughened measures of social distancing.
Some of those measures include reducing school attendance to one-third capacity, closing off sports stadiums to fans, and prohibiting all churches from holding in-person services. Kim says officials are still trying to track down and test several hundred Sarangjaeol church members before they can spread the disease any further.
And as for some 600 people who we failed to get in touch of, we are cooperating closely with the police to identify all of the members of the church.
Kim says some church members might have spread the virus even more after joining a large anti-government demonstration last weekend in Seoul. A video of the rally is on the church's YouTube channel. It was led by Pastor Jun Kwon-hoon, who's not wearing a face covering. Pastor Jun is an outspoken figure in South Korea's conservative Protestant community, and he uses social media to criticize and spread conspiracies about liberal President Moon Jae-in. At the rally, he suggested the government infected his church with what he called the Wuhan virus. He called health officials communists and North Korean sympathizers. Days after the rally, the government announced that Jun had tested positive for COVID-19 and was in the hospital. It's unusual for patients' names to be revealed. And now some people are saying Jun got what he deserved. More than 300,000 people have signed an online petition calling for his arrest. There was a similar reaction back in February when South Korea's first coronavirus outbreak occurred in a church that is widely seen as a cult. That group's leader was arrested earlier this month. Some observers believe that certain churches, like Pastor Jun's, are being used as a scapegoat. Song Jae-rong, who lectures on religion at Seoul's Kyunghee University, says COVID infections were on the rise even before last weekend's rally.
I think it seems to be easy to be blaming the anti-Moon Jae-in government rally together with the Jun Kwon-hoon's as a responsibility of the second major infection.
Song says the government has encouraged big gatherings too, like last month's funeral for Seoul's mayor. Koo Se-young, a former South Korean journalist and religion scholar, says it seems that Pastor Jun and his very conservative church are being singled out.
I don't think many people would deny the fact that the church has acted incredibly irresponsibly. But at the same time, one could also argue that the kind of approach we're seeing from the government toward this particular church, yeah, it does have a political dimension.
Koo says one thing officials could do is find a gentler way to encourage the already mistrustful church members to come in for testing.
They need to focus on the fact that this is a public health crisis, and it's important to avoid scapegoating.
And reassure the pastor's followers that despite their political views, they'll be treated fairly. Outside the closed-off Sarangjaeol Church, men with walkie-talkies are standing guard, including one guy who didn't want to give his name. He claims he's not a congregant, but says that church worshippers are just trying to prevent a communist takeover of their country. That's why, he says, the government and media are blaming them for spreading the coronavirus. For The World, I'm Jason Strother in Seoul.
You're listening to The World.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Bill Gates has spent a lot of his time thinking about viruses and vaccines since he left the board of Microsoft earlier this year to focus on his foundation. He's poured billions of his own money into the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. His and his wife's efforts to try and save millions of lives threatened by any number of health issues. Still, rumors and conspiracy theories circulate to undermine his efforts. Some people claim he wants to implant tracking devices in vaccines, or that he even caused the most recent pandemic. Gates pushed back against these theories when speaking with The Economist magazine.
You know, it's hard for me, because I'm so, you know, science-oriented, to even, you know, go, oh, come on. Not really. People don't really believe that. Those things are completely untrue. And to the degree they cause people not to wear masks or seek out the vaccine, you know, or to think this is all some big conspiracy, that's unfortunate.
Portions of Bill Gates' interview with the magazine can be heard in this week's edition of The Economist Asks podcast. Its host is Anne McElvoy, who joins us now from London. And you've actually been on holiday for a couple of weeks, so it was The Economist magazine's editor-in-chief, Zanny Minton-Beddoes, who stepped in and spoke with Bill Gates this time. But you've met and spoken with Gates before. When you heard this most recent interview, did anything strike you?
Well, a couple of things leapt out at me, Marco. One is that when I've interviewed Bill Gates before, frankly, I've often found him a little bit slippery on politics, on the social implications of his work. Here he was much more outspoken. I think that the pandemic has probably sharpened a lot of his views and made him more willing to come forwards with them. By implication, he's addressing that Trump divide of people who believe some things, don't believe others, and are pretty choosy about what that is. And he does acknowledge that it's a major problem in getting to grips with COVID-19.
I've got a couple more things to ask you about Bill Gates, but let's hear a bit more from Gates himself. This is his conversation with The Economist Zanny Minton-Beddoes.
How much do you need government there? Is there more that you could do? I mean, the foundation has already played a big role. Could you step up and do even more?
That would be kind of wild, because governments bring a certain legitimacy to this thing and working with other governments, and the delivery systems are going to be in the hands of the public health system in those governments. So, yes, our foundation has spent hundreds of millions. If it was necessary, we'll spend a lot more than that. But having a private foundation try and take the lead on the financing the vaccine, that's never been the case, you know, for HIV or malaria. But somehow this money is going to get raised.
It shouldn't be necessary, but we're in this extraordinary moment of, you know, lack of global leadership, lack of multilateralism, and a raging pandemic. Maybe this is the time when, you know, you are one of the few people who is sort of able to really push the needle on this. And actually, it will take that to break this impasse amongst governments.
Well, since it's not a market-driven thing to get all these factories going, we are putting out some high-risk money now. And we understand where the factories are for the various vaccine constructs. So, you know, we're working with the various Indian manufacturers who have a lot of capacity. They don't as much invent new vaccines, but they're actually the highest volume manufacturer in the world. So we're trying to stitch it together, and in the next few months, as the U.S. gets its plan organized, or, you know, if we have to do something extraordinary, I do think by the end of the year, we'll get these factories organized, because the impact is so high.
That's Bill Gates speaking with The Economist. Anne McElvoy, Bill Gates dropped out of Harvard, where he studied math and computer science, but now he speaks with authority on medical issues, environmental issues, because, I mean, he has money and privilege most people could never even imagine having. Does he recognize that because of sheer economic scale he's able to even be in the room with these scientists?
I think it's a really good question, because there are lots of challenges to philanthropists picking and choosing what they do with their immense wealth. And Bill Gates is not immune to that charge. It's something we have often asked him about. I think what he's saying now is it's hard to disagree that governments and private individuals should get together to combat the coronavirus, because its global effects are so damaging, not just in the immediate death toll and suffering, but in terms of the economy, climate change, and lots of other things. So my feeling is that he is pivoting much more towards saying we can be part of an answer working with governments. He says at one point in the interview, this is largely going to be led by governments, but that he feels he can contribute to it. And that divide, I think he now recognises, needs to be healed a bit rather than saying, I'm a philanthropist, I'll do what the heck I like.
There was so much more discussed in that conversation between Gates and The Economist Asks. And someone like Bill Gates, who is forward-thinking, someone who seeks solutions, is he optimistic and trying to understand the scale of the damage this pandemic has caused?
Half in half. He thinks that the divides are not going to heal so easily. He was, I think, very pragmatic about that. People are not just going to change their minds tomorrow about what they think. But on the upside, which is something to hang on to, I came home and immediately told my family about, he did say 2021 is the breakthrough year. He thinks we will get to a workable vaccine to roll out from 2021. And the question is, how far, how fast, who will have access to it? To that extent, he thinks that we're perhaps at the bottom of the V shape at the moment, but the only way is up.
Anne McElvoy, host of the podcast The Economist Asks. Thanks very much. Good to speak with you again.
Great to join you.
So the sun is setting earlier. We're nearly at the end of August, but don't be glum. It is still summer. So on this Friday, a smash debut for a summer song just hitting the airwaves. 'Cause I'm in the stars tonight. So watch me bring the fire, set the night light. Shoes on, get up in the morning, cup of milk, let's rock and roll. Feels like we just heard from BTS this summer. And then last night at 00:00 hour, the Korean boy band dropped their new single, Dynamite. As far as their global legion of fans are concerned, the BTS Army, there are no time zones, and nearly 4 million people tuned in for the premiere of the music video, smashing the previous record that was set just last month by K-pop girl group Blackpink. BTS described their new song as disco pop with a fun and cheery vibe. The outfits and dance moves in the video definitely capture that. Shining through the city with the little funky song. The BTS Army will notice what's different about this track from the rest of the band's music. Dynamite is their first song performed entirely in English. At a press conference yesterday, the seven lads in BTS said that wasn't initially the plan, but when COVID-19 hit, it inspired them to release a new track ASAP to cheer up their global fan base. Here's band member Jin.
쉽지는 않았지만 영어로 녹음해보니까 저희가 이전에 작업한 곡과는 또 다른
We wanted to send messages of hope and encouragement in the form of what we do best, which is singing and dancing. Recording the song in English was not easy, and it definitely felt different from our previous works. But I think this will show the fans a new side of BTS.
The group said they just want their tune to bring happiness and healing to as many people as possible. Dynamite is the fastest song to reach number one in 100 countries, so I'd say, guys, job well done. Before we take a quick break, let me offer a recommendation for your weekend listening. You must check out our smart speaker show, The Number in the News. 7 days a week, you'll get a number, and one story about why that number is in the news. 7 episodes a week means you don't have to wait for Monday to hear more from the world. Find The Number in the News on Google and Amazon smart speakers, or head over to theworld.org/smartspeaker. Everything you hate about a Zoom call, it's kind of endearing when it's a Zoom wedding.
Turn us on.
Hello. An Argentine marries a Russian in Texas. RSVPs from around the globe. We'll take you to the virtual ceremony coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of WGBH Boston and PRX. Nearly 2 weeks after a presidential election in Belarus, many people there remain unhappy with the result. And protests, as we've been reporting, have become a daily occurrence. Protesters there in the capital, Minsk, they want President Alexander Lukashenko to go and are calling for new, free and fair elections. The government's response has been harsh.
Now, more than 6,000 people were detained. This is official information, but we think it will be more.
That's Belarusian human rights activist Valentin Stefanovich. One of the estimated 6,000 people detained is an American citizen named Vitaly Shklarov. Reporter Charles Maines joins us from Moscow. Charles, who is Vitaly Shklarov?
Well, Shklarov is a political analyst and a columnist in Western and Russian independent media. He was born in Belarus but married an American diplomat, so has U.S. citizenship. And he's made quite a name for himself also as a campaign strategist. He worked on the campaigns of both Barack Obama in 2008 and Bernie Sanders during his run for the presidency in 2016. Although, as he tells it, he was at the time struggling to learn English and perfect his English. I did an interview with him for The World in 2018 when he was working on a campaign here in Moscow. And he recalled how he tried to explain to Americans why it was so important that they get out and vote.
I grew up in a country where nobody asked me what president I would love to elect. Nobody even asked me, like, who I am. Like, nobody cared. And here you go. You have, like, this democracy. You can, like, actively voice your opinion, and you can actively influence the decision-making. And this is actually amazing.
Shklarov would say that by making this argument to these Americans, in fact, he would convince them. This was kind of his closing argument for them to get out and vote, and usually they said they would.
Mm. So what was Shklarov doing in Belarus, and do we know how he was detained?
Well, he was detained on July 29th. He was visiting his parents in his hometown of Grodno, along with his son. Apparently, the story is he stepped out to run an errand at his parents' home and was snatched up by the Belarusian KGB. All he had time to do was post a quick message to social media, to his Telegram channel, saying, arrested.
Do we have any idea why?
Well, formally, he's charged with trying to violate the public order through would-be coordination with the campaign of a political blogger named Sergei Tikhanovsky. Of course, this has all happened against the charges of vote rigging by President Alexander Lukashenko, which has led to these mass protests throughout the country. And so Lukashenko is trying to portray the opposition as stooges of the West, which is where Shklarov comes in, according to his lawyer, Anton Gashinsky. So Gashinsky says that Vitaly essentially became a scapegoat for Lukashenko's security forces. He kind of fits this picture that they're trying to draw of foreigners from abroad trying to organize a revolution.
What have you learned about his case, Charles, and conditions of his detention?
Shklarov paints a pretty grim picture. He released a letter to Novaya Gazeta. This is a newspaper here in Moscow that he writes for from time to time. And he says, as someone who criticized Lukashenko, he always figured prison was a possibility, but the conditions that he's in are far more inhumane and essentially designed to break him, according to his words. You know, he describes this dirty, overcrowded cells, no hot water, the lights never go out, there's patriotic Soviet music blasting through the prison all the time. And he says he's also been denied contact with family members through mail, that his writings and letters are read and confiscated. And anytime he's complained, it's led to these stints in a vertical isolation cell called the stakan, that's Russian for glass, with no room to sit. So a lot of psychological pressure. And of course, with these charges against him, he faces the possibility of a 3-year prison sentence.
Wow. Reporter Charles Maine speaking with us from Moscow about one person among many detained in the post-election chaos in Belarus. Charles, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo made a tough accusation against our European allies. The Europeans on the UN Security Council said the U.S. cannot reimpose sanctions on Iran. Pompeo responded that the U.S. has had the courage and conviction to stand up to Iran, and Europe has not.
Instead, they chose to side with the Ayatollahs. Their actions endanger the people of Iraq, of Yemen, of Lebanon, of Syria, and indeed their own citizens as well.
Pompeo has been trying in vain to get European support for reinstating sanctions on Iran. 2 years ago, the Trump administration withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal, which was negotiated by the Obama administration. Wendy Sherman was that administration's chief negotiator back in 2015. Ambassador Sherman, thanks for being with us. The Trump administration says Iran has violated the terms of the 2015 nuclear deal, and so sanctions should snap back. A snapback was a provision in the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Can you explain what it does, and do the conditions currently exist for a snapback?
When we negotiated the what's known as the Iran Nuclear Agreement, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, we wanted to make sure that if Iran was in deep violation of the agreement, that any country who had been a participant and was a participant of the deal could go to the UN and snap back the multilateral sanctions. The Trump administration left the deal in 2018, loudly saying by the President of the United States that we were no longer a participant in the deal. And so yesterday you heard Germany, Great Britain, and France, all members of the agreement, say that the United States was no longer a participant because it had left the deal, therefore has no standing at the United Nations on this matter, and cannot snap back sanctions.
The sanctions on Iran that were lifted when the nuclear deal was signed, are those sanctions still in place, and can Iran still kind of weave around them?
The United States, under the Trump administration, reimposed all of the sanctions that had been lifted as a result of the agreement. And what they are seeking at the United Nations is to have the multilateral UN sanctions reimposed on Iran, even with the maximum pressure campaign. Some countries haven't fully complied with the U.S. unilateral sanctions. It's one of the reasons why the administration wants the multilateral sanctions to go back into effect, because they believe then they would have a better chance of fully enforcing all of the sanctions, both unilateral and multilateral, that were lifted as a result of the agreement.
What condition is the Iran nuclear deal in at this point?
Well, it's very concerning because of the maximum pressure campaign and other actions by the Trump administration. Very unfortunately, the Iranians have started to take steps in the wrong direction. So they are enriching uranium at a higher percentage, a higher concentration. They are increasing their stockpile of enriched uranium. They are using and researching more advanced centrifuges, the mechanisms that enrich uranium. They are looking at how they can now restart their plutonium program, another path to the material needed for a nuclear weapon. So it is quite concerning because it means that the breakout time, the time needed to get enough material for a nuclear weapon, has decreased significantly.
Wendy Sherman was the chief negotiator of the 2015 nuclear deal with Iran when she was serving as Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs in the Obama administration. She's currently a professor at the Harvard Kennedy School. Ambassador Sherman, thank you very much for helping us understand all this.
Thank you, Marco. Take care.
The Roma, they are Europe's largest ethnic minority. They're also among its most persecuted and impoverished. 80% of Roma communities live below the poverty line. And for many, the pandemic has made things a whole lot worse. Our Europe correspondent Orla Barry has this story. And a warning to listeners, you may find some of the content in Orla's reporting troubling.
When the coronavirus first started to spread through Eastern Europe, Roma communities felt under attack. But not because of the virus itself. Police in Slovakia and Bulgaria cordoned off entire districts where Roma lived.
The whole neighborhood was closed, like with checkpoints in entrances and exits of the neighborhood.
This is Mikhail Mishev with the Roma Standing Conference, a Roma support group in Bulgaria. Police said they needed to quarantine the Roma districts to prevent the virus spreading. The Bulgarian Interior Minister said the shutdowns were necessary to protect the rest of the population. But Mishev says closing off the communities had a detrimental effect.
Most of the people working outside of the neighborhood lost their jobs because in a small city, for example, in Jambu, actually, let's take Jambu, the whole city was closed. Nobody could enter or exit the neighborhood. And more than a couple hundred people lost their jobs.
Intimidation by police is nothing new for many Roma, particularly communities living in Eastern Europe. Jonathan Lee is with the European Roma Rights Centre. He says some police forces have been using the pandemic as an excuse to carry out indiscriminate raids on Roma neighbourhoods.
Once institutionally racist police forces knew that the media aren't watching to a certain extent, the courts are paralysed, NGOs were not able to get in the field so much, it really didn't take long for these sort of cases to start arising.
Lee says the police raids were also noticeably more aggressive.
We don't normally see on this scale gendarmes using tear gas on women and children in apartment blocks. We don't see kids being beaten with truncheons. We don't see police pulling men out of the house, tying them up, beating them on the ground for something that's alleged breaking of lockdown rules.
One case in particular drew national attention in Romania. Lee forwards me a video taken on a smartphone of a police raid on a Roma family in Bolintin Valle, a town in southern Romania. In the footage, you can see five men lying face down on the ground. To the side, one man is screaming in pain. Lee explains what's happening.
They took out some men from the house, nylon tied them on the floor, and took off one of their shoes and started whipping the bare soles of his feet. It's really like punitive actions for no reason. And his wife or his female member of his family is filming. And you can hear the police officer saying in Romanian, of course, like, why are you filming? You think anyone cares? These are just gypsies. No one cares. Or put this on Facebook.
A criminal investigation has been launched into the case. But Lee says most other complaints of violent incidents not caught on camera have been rejected. Police intimidation, however, is not the community's only worry. The pandemic means, while many Roma have lost their jobs, others feel under pressure to work. Mihai Bica, who's originally from Romania, is a policy worker with the Roma Support Group in the UK.
After the start of the lockdown, they were offered, you know, 6-7 days a week work. And many took that as an opportunity to make some more money for the family. Others felt pressure from their companies, from their employers, that they have to go to work, otherwise they will lose their job and so on.
Bica says this led to a spike in the virus among Roma families in Britain. Many Roma live in close quarters. If someone in the family contracts the virus, they've nowhere to go to self-isolate. Like most kids in the UK, Roma children have been out of school for months. But for Roma families, there are additional challenges. Homeschooling is tough, particularly for some parents who may not have finished school themselves. And Bica says most Roma children cannot follow classes on the internet.
The vast majority of Roma could not access the online learning facilities available. Even if they had a smartphone in the house, they didn't know how to go, you know, online, access the online class or whatever.
In parts of Europe, Roma communities have been blamed for spreading the virus. Bulgarian lawmaker Angel Jambaski issued a statement asking if, quote, Roma ghettos could turn out to be the real nests of contagion. Mikhail Mishev says he often experiences discrimination in Bulgaria because of his Roma heritage.
There are places in, like bars and public pools and restaurants that don't serve Roma people. For example, I was trying to relax in one public pool, and they told me that during the weekends I cannot enter because I'm Roma, so they would not let me in.
I ask Mishev if he stood his ground.
I tried to argue, but the guard there, he was a big guy, so yeah, I was kind of scared.
Discrimination against Roma isn't just confined to Eastern Europe. There have been reported incidents in Belgium, Ireland and the Netherlands in the past couple of months too. Jonathan Lee with the European Roma Rights Centre says some local authorities have made efforts to work with the communities during the pandemic. But the biggest issue, he says, is that Roma people are rarely included in major policy decisions.
They're somehow rendered invisible to policymakers in these countries. And during the coronavirus pandemic, there should be crisis groups which have Roma and Roma civil society experts on them.
The European Commission is set to release a new strategy in October, aimed at improving the lives of the Roma people across the EU. But the recommendations are non-binding, and most Roma activists aren't holding their breath. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
Watching a movie at home these days doesn't come with quite the same potpourri of aromas you'd get from going out to an actual movie theater. You know, popcorn butter, recirculated air, the wrinkly hot dogs in the rotisserie behind the concession stand. A London candle shop wants to bring these aromas back into your life. They've created a new line of candles called Sense of Normality. That's S-C-E-N-T-S. Paul Furman is co-creator of Earl of East Candles. So you've got cinema, as I said, Paul, in case people were missing their artificial butter smells. What are some of your other candle scents and what aromas stand out?
For this collection, we actually worked in partnership with Uncommon, which is a creative agency based in London. And they approached us with the idea to kind of recreate the places people had missed most. So the cinema is obviously, I think, without doubt, one of those for a lot of people. But we've also created the festival. The lead note in that candle is cut grass, but there is kind of hemp and cannabis oil in there. And then we also created the local, you know, the pub is kind of a staple in people in the UK's weekly lives. So, yeah, we recreated that scent too.
I mean, people who are thinking, you know, like sandalwood are sadly mistaken here. Like the pub candle, you've got top notes of spilt beer and the fat off of French fries. So, I mean, you're not just capturing the good, but also the bad. How'd you decide which kind of aromatic notes to include?
It was quite clear. I mean, you can't have a pub without beer, or a festival without cannabis, or a cinema without popcorn. So it was a really fun project to work on.
You're a candle maker and a business person, but why do you think scent in particular is so tied to people's memories?
Scent and memory are really closely linked because it's the same part of the brain that decode both. So that's why you can be walking down the street and the smell of smoke might instantly remind you of a grandparent or an uncle, or a perfume can literally transport you to a place or time. I think at this time, that whole idea of nostalgia, I don't think anybody could have predicted what would happen. And I think it was those simple things that people really craved. You know, I don't think people necessarily miss the smell of a pub, if they're being honest, but not being able to experience it, there was something quite nice about that. I think what's been interesting is it's one of the ones out of the three scents that people have really responded to after. We've seen a lot of people like posting pictures of them recreating like pub food and lighting it as part of a almost like a ritual of recreating something they've missed during that time. And I think that's really nice.
What are some of the other smells that you miss, Paul, from before lockdown?
In the very early days, kind of March and April, the things I was missing were more associated with food. Like the smell of going past like a bakery or a coffee shop, they were the things that I really missed. So yeah, quite foodie smells. I'm still at this point really missing the smell of the ocean, and definitely kind of craving that a little bit, particularly as some people are starting to travel again. And we've kind of made a conscious decision not to, but seeing it everywhere on social and stuff is kind of making me really crave that at the moment.
Paul Furman, the co-creator behind Earl of East Candles in London, their new line, Sense of Normality, captures the smells of some of the places you may have missed during the lockdown. Paul, thank you so much for your time. Good to speak.
Thank you.
Okay, here's the question.
Who let the dogs out?
The Baja Men there with the question that won him a Grammy some 20 years ago. It also got baseball fans stomping in the bleachers.
Who let the dogs out?
But back to that central question, who let the dogs out? If you're in Germany, it better be you. Twice a day, totaling at least an hour of outdoor time. That's according to a new proposal by Germany's Minister of Food and Agriculture, Julia Klöckner. Besides the requirement to exercise dogs outside of their kennel or home for an hour a day, the law would also make it illegal to keep dogs chained outside for long periods of time, because it ain't nice, and dogs can also go stir crazy. And that's how I keep my pup busy when the weather sucks. Don't worry, we're playing the pull the rope game. He's totally gentle. Frankie and I do walk and run a lot. In Germany, there are a lot of dogs that need exercise. One in every five Germans owns a dog. That's 16 million pooches that should be out and about. It's unclear how this proposal would affect dog owners. A ministry official has clarified no one will be checking up, actually enforcing the walking part of the law. Instead, it seems the proposal may be directed mainly at breeders, tightening restrictions on how many litters breeders are allowed to supervise at one time. The law also requires that they play with puppies for at least 4 hours a day. Seriously? Can I have that job? Because it sounds great. But hang on a minute to that dream, because the German proposal has been met with some backlash on social media. Many opponents are saying it's an overstep by German leaders. Stay in your own backyard, government, wrote one Twitter user. And another explained that his dog would not be able to walk even 2 minutes in the heat, much less an hour. But we know several big supporters of such a law from around our newsroom. I'm looking at you, Scout. And Winnie, the water-loving lab. And Wilbur.
Come on!
All of them very good boys and girls. So have you ever been to a wedding where a dog is the ring bearer? It is a thing, probably not this year, though. It's not the most ideal wedding season, to say the least. Many couples have postponed because of the pandemic. Others have gone ahead with ceremonies, just much smaller than planned, with guests social distancing. Then you've got the couples that have moved things online. And if they have family spread across the globe, that can actually be a blessing in disguise. Reporter Lucia Benavides in Barcelona attended her brother's Zoom wedding recently, and Lucia graciously offered us this insider's view of the nuptials.
Since my family and I moved from Argentina to the U.S. in 1998, my two brothers and I often wondered what we'd do when and if we married. Do we ask our Argentine relatives to travel? Do we ask our American friends to come with us to Argentina? Do we get married twice? We could have never imagined that a pandemic would eventually decide that for us. At least for one of us, my brother Santi, who married his Russian girlfriend Jenya on July 31st. The only ones present were my parents in their Austin, Texas home. Even the Justice of the Peace participated virtually.
Welcome everyone who is attending today. I can hear that we've got a wonderful group of family and friends. And I have been experiencing some beautiful 21st century weddings with Zoom.
There were attendees in multiple time zones. Friends and family in Argentina, Croatia, Spain, Italy, France, Turkey, Russia, Kazakhstan, Singapore, Canada, and various U.S. states. The 30 little squares containing different faces in an array of living rooms and kitchens were overwhelming. After the vows, it was a classic Zoom moment where nobody was muted.
Turn us on.
Hello.
Приветствуем вас на нашей постцеремониальной вечеринке.
When someone spoke up, everybody could hear, and not everyone spoke the same language.
Sorry, can I take 1 second to translate into Russian? I have Russian family. That's a great question. I was about to ask about giving time for translations in any language, so do that now. Okay. Мое дорогое семейство и друзья, сейчас нам отключили микрофон всем.
There were three languages interwoven throughout the ceremony: English, Russian, and Spanish. But there was one part that needed no translation.
By the authority vested in me by the state of Texas as a justice of the peace for Travis County, I happily pronounce you husband and wife. You may kiss. Congratulations!
People shouted in Spanish, Vivan los novios, long live the newlyweds. And Jenya's Russian relatives chanted Gorka, which I learned that day means the couple has to kiss every time it's said. I still don't know who picked up the violin at that point. It was too hard to keep up with who was doing what. After the initial champagne popping, the celebration continued for 3 hours. Let me repeat that, a 3-hour Zoom call. But it was a lot of fun. There were nonstop speeches, maybe the most I've ever heard at any wedding. People looked on and listened, or waited for a translation, and sometimes cried, or poured more champagne, or got up to deal with a whining child in the next room. Of course, there were technical difficulties. That's my aunt yelling at my grandma to mute herself. There were even a couple of musical performances. It's not the wedding I would have imagined for my little brother. For starters, I would have liked to hug him after he took his vows. I would have liked to hug my new sister, my parents, make jokes with my other brother about being left behind, dance with my cousins, gotten to know my new Russian family. But realistically, that kind of celebration wouldn't have been possible, regardless of any pandemic. It's just part of life when your loved ones are spread across the globe. This was perhaps the only way to really have everyone present. For the world, Lucia Benavides, Barcelona.
And life goes on, weddings and all. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman, stepping away from the mic for a few days. Carol Hills will be with you on Monday. You all stay strong, stay safe, and have a great weekend.